This is 3:25:32. Again, the senses led by the mind act under the influence of the demigods. When the service is ultimately aimed at the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the senses are in their natural position. The Lord is called Rishikesha, for he is actually the proprietor and the ultimate master of the senses. The senses and the mind are naturally inclined to work, but when they are materially contaminated, they work for some material benefit or for the service of the demigods, although actually they are meant to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The senses are called Rishika, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead is called Rishikesha. Indirectly, all the senses are naturally inclined to serve the Supreme Lord. That is called bhakti. Kapila Dev said that when the senses, without desire for material profit or other selfish motives, are engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is situated in devotional service. That spirit of service is far better than siddhi, liberation. Or Prabhupada uses the word here, salvation. Bhakti, the inclination to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is in a transcendental position far better than mukti or liberation. Thus bhakti is the stage above liberation. Unless one is liberated, one cannot engage the senses in the service of the Lord. When the senses are engaged either in material activities of sense gratification or in the activities of the Vedic injunctions, there is some motive. But when the same senses are engaged in the service of the Lord and there is no motive, that is called annimitta, and it is the natural inclination of the mind. The conclusion is that when the mind, without being deviated either by the Vedic injunctions or by the material activities, is fully engaged in Krishna consciousness or devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is far better than the most aspired for liberation from material entanglement. Śrīmad-Bhāgavata uvacha devānām guṇalingānām anuśrāvaka karmanām sattva evaika manaso vṛttik svabhāviki tuya animitā bhagavati. Bhakti siddhirgariya si vṛtti svabhāviki. The natural function. Now it says of the demigods, Prabhupada, it is word for word synonym, says of the senses or the presiding deities of the senses. This Prabhupada gets from the commentaries on Auracharyas. The word deva is usually understood to mean demigod, but in this context we're talking about the natural activity of the demigods. The natural activity is devotional service. Why should that apply only to the demigods in heaven? We understand, the devotees in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that anyone can become a devotee. You don't have to be a demigod. There's no particular great advantage of being a demigod. It doesn't make it better or easier for you to become a devotee. Some other Vaishnavas have a different slant on that. In the Madhva Sampradaya, it is their idea that the demigods are definitely the best devotees. And if you want to get liberation, if you want to become a perfect devotee, and in their conception, the perfection of devotional service is liberation. Not that liberation is only a stepping stone to devotion, but devotion is the sadhana for liberation. Liberation is the perfection. Because it's personal liberation. It means to go to Vaikuntha and engage in the service of God. But the word they use, the idea, what they're aiming for is liberation, mukti. And bhakti is the sadhana, the means. And more specifically, if you want to get that mukti, you've got to become a demigod. Not only become a demigod, you've got to go through the whole hierarchy, 100 lifetimes after another. Shata Janmana, the statement in the Bhagavatam, that by doing your prescribed duty for 100 years, you can become Lord Brahma. That statement in the Bhagavatam. But the followers of Madhvacharya take that to mean that you have to do that. But there's no other path of liberation. You have to become Lord Brahma. Only Lord Brahma gets liberation. Everyone else is only on the waiting list. And there's 100 positions on the waiting list. You've got to move up one step at a time. It takes 100 lifetimes. Just like, according to them, Sri Vadiraj Tirtha, who was a great reformer in the Madhva line in the 15th century, he's going to become the next Vayu. And Vayu is number two on the waiting list. Now, Vayu is next best after Brahma. Vayu in his next life, after being Vayu, he can become Brahma, and then he can get the liberation. So only the demigods are the best devotees. And if you don't become a demigod, then you're just, you know, off the waiting list. You don't even have any chance of getting a seat on the liberation train. That's not our view. This is not the teaching of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. What about Prahlad? He was a Rakshasa, son of a great demon. But we count him as one of the greatest devotees. What about the young women of Vrindavan, who are just gwalas, you know, not very civilized human beings, not very prestigious position, but they're the greatest devotees. So we have to understand this verse differently, because we don't think that the demigods are the only real devotees. Being a demigod doesn't have much to do with being a pure devotee. So devas, as Prabhupada explains, because Srila, probably Sridhar Swami, and Jiva Goswami, and Vishnu, we can look at the commentaries, take it to mean the senses. But why do you call the senses devas? Because it also means the deities who rule the senses. So the natural activity of the senses is what? It's bhakti, devotional service. Natural. What is natural to you is what will be the easiest to do. To do something that's against your nature, that's not going to be easy. And it's not going to be good for you. It's not going to be wholesome and healthy. People get sick. People get old prematurely. People have short lives and miserable lives because they're behaving and living unnaturally, against their proper nature. Now, you should eat according to your prakriti, your constitution. You should act and work according to your constitution. What's natural? But that's just on the material level. On the spiritual level, our nature is to serve Krishna, our actual natural condition. And if we're not serving Krishna, We're asking to get sick, to be miserable, and suffer so many restrictions in our life. The symptom of that material illness, of living an unnatural life, is restriction, loss of freedom. The more sinful you are, the more rebellious you are against your natural position of being Krishna's servant. The more you try not to be Krishna's servant, the more constricted your life is, down to the position of those who are in the mode of ignorance. The dumb animals, the plants and trees, they, just when you get down to the vegetative species, then you have no ability even to move. You're stuck in one place. No matter how difficult, painful the conditions are, you can't even move away. At least we, if it's hot outside, we can move into the shade. But a tree cannot easily do that. He can shift his limbs. There's room over here in the back. Room back here. And those who are, even in human bodies, those who are tamasic, they get their, more and more of their freedom taken away. The more sinful you are, the less freedom you're left with. And the more pious you are, the more freedom and power you're given. You can become a demigod. You can fly in the sky without having to put petrol into your gas tank. Now, without fuel, you can fly everywhere you want. We may have a vehicle, we may have a car, but if there's a shortage of petrol, we don't have money to buy it, then we can't go anywhere. Yeah, I think in Australia, what they did sometimes, they'd engage the bushman in some menial work, and then pay him by giving him a car with, you know, half a liter of petrol in the tank. And then the bushman would happily, you know, he didn't know how to drive, but he, you know, it's a desert, so he could just wander off into the desert with his car. And then after, you know, an hour of driving, the petrol went out, and he didn't know what to do. So he just abandoned the car and walked away, and then the owners of the car, the employees would come back and retrieve the car. You know, no fuel, you can't go anywhere.
Is that Australian history?
I heard about that, yeah.
Okay.
but if you can be elevated to the mode of goodness, you can have a vehicle that will drive without fuel. Just on the air. Perpetual glider that can go anywhere you want, and you're free to travel practically all over the universe. If you're a grihastha, you won't be allowed without a visa into Maharloka and the upper, into Janatapa Satyaloka. They're generally only for the celibates. But beside that, in the lower regions below those celibate planets, the demigods can go anywhere they want. And they can do practically anything they want. That's freedom. The more you are sattvic, the more freedom you're given. The more tamasic you are, the less and less freedom you have. But absolute freedom is gained by living an absolutely natural way of life. Sattva, sattve. The meaning of sattvam is to abide by your true nature. Sattvam means your character, your nature, what you are. When you act as what you really are, not try to be something you're not, that is living in the mode of sattva, goodness. What's good about it is it's natural and easy. Just like, and then you have to, I'm sorry, bhakti is that natural life, according to this definition of Kapilavastu. Although it is understood, the word bhakti has two meanings. Jiva Goswami points this out. That the word bhakti can mean the natural, perfect, spontaneous mode of living in which one senses and minds are completely engaged in the glorification and the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the higher sense of bhakti. But there's also bhakti for those who have material attachments, who are still conditioned and don't have the spontaneous inclination to serve Krishna. For them, bhakti means the practice of bhakti, the reformatory practice of regulated devotional service. Just like healthy life is an automatic thing for someone who's not sick. You know, he already has good habits. You know, he eats nicely, he gets exercise. So just his daily routine is wholesome. It's the life he's already living. But when he gets sick, seriously, he goes to the doctor, and then the doctor sends him to the hospital, and all of a sudden he's lying in a bed and told, you know, that you can only eat this and that, and pumped full of medicines. His life has become very restricted while he's under medical treatment in the hospital. But that is also therapeutic. It is good for him. We don't conceive of it as good to take, have all our liberties taken away. And also for someone to come with a knife and cut us up. But when the surgeon does it, that's to save us. And when we are forced to accept the restrictions of living in the hospital, that's for making us healthy, so that we can go back out and again live our natural, normal life. It's not normal to be stuck in the hospital and go through what they make you go through there. But if it will bring you back to your normal condition, then it is the right thing for you. So the devotional practice, the discipline that revives your natural consciousness. You mean like going to the hospital? Yeah, I mean some people have some hospital stays are horrible. Sometimes they just send you, you know, on vacation to the sanatorium to bask in the sun and read books. You know, the hospital stay doesn't have to be miserable. There are different kinds of hospital stays. So for some, devotional service is bad. In the sense it's horrible, it's difficult. Especially for people who are seriously ill, who are infected by the mode of tamas. For them to now engage in the discipline of bhakti yoga is painful, a struggle. Whereas someone in the mode of ignorance, a mode of goodness, you know, chant Krishna's names, read the Bhagavatam, you know, for him it's pleasant. It's like spending, you know, a week in the sanatorium on vacation. It's not, you know, for one, a hospital stay is miserable and frightening, and for another, it's pleasant. It depends on who you are, what your illness is. But it is discipline. It is a therapy. It is necessary for recovering our natural condition. Even though you may think that the discipline itself, what's natural about that? But it's not that the discipline is meant to be natural. It's not that the medicine is just for your sense gratification. The medical treatment is for your sense gratification. You may have to go through some trouble, but in order to rectify it, to regain your natural condition. So bhakti means both. But the word bhakti is used to refer to the natural, easy, pleasant life of just serving God. But it also means doing whatever you have to do to regain that condition is also called bhakti. Because both of them are the proper use of your mind and senses. If you're sick, then the proper thing to do is to get well. Take the treatment. And if you're well, the proper thing to do is enjoy your life. So they're both bhakti. They're both, by this definition of Kapiladeva, both of them are bhakti. Both the spontaneous loving service and the disciplined practice are the natural proper use of the senses, depending on your condition. That's why he's speaking in general terms here. He was speaking even more generally before, just about liberation. Now that he's getting to the point of bhakti, he's starting with general definition of bhakti. That applies both to the sadhakas and to the perfect devotees. In general, what's bhakti? We can deal with the details after we've got a general definition. General definition is this. It's the natural use of your mind and senses. And then that's the what we call tatthi swarup lakshana, the essential defining quality. The one thing that cannot be removed without destroying it. If what you're doing is in no way even indirectly connected with your natural function of serving God, then it's not devotional service. I can play the guitar for Krishna's service if I do it in an authorized way. Okay, we want to send a bhajan band to Mongolia, and they like guitar bands over there in Mongolia. So you're recruited. You used to play the guitar. Get out your guitar, practice a little bit, and we'll send you out with the bhajan band. So that's your authorized service. Being used for Krishna's service, for practical, authorized preaching work. But otherwise, you know, you've got your guitar and you waste time playing it for no good reason. That's not devotional service. Same activity. It has to be, the essential characteristic that must be there is that it must be fulfilling your real function of being a servant of God. It must be tied into the service of God, directly or indirectly. Indirectly, maybe. Those who perform Vedic sacrifices are indirectly worshipping the Supreme Lord. Yetu anya devata bhakta, those who are devotees of other demigods. Yajante, they perform Vedic sacrifices. Yaj means to perform Vedic sacrifice. Shradayanvita, and they're full of faith. I'm missing a few words, but they're worshipping me actually. But it's not the direct process. It's not the way I prefer. Okay, they can worship Indra, pour some oblations and chant some mantras, and I get my share of the sacrifice. I get the first share. Yageshwara, Krishna understands. So okay, even though he's not thinking of me, at least he's worshiping me through my representative, Indra, and other demigods. So it's indirect devotional service. Following the Vedic process of sacrifice is Krishna's subconsciousness. You're not aware, but you're doing it. You're serving Krishna indirectly through his representative. Either way, directly or indirectly, consciously, unconsciously, if it has to be for the pleasure of the Lord. Otherwise, there's no way to call it any kind of bhakti. That's the essential characteristic. But then Kapila also gives some additional characteristics. Maybe there, may not be there. But if you want the best bhakti, you should have the additional characteristics. Animitta. Bhagavati, actually that's just the one. Animitta. Best kind of devotional service has to be causeless. If you've got material ulterior motives, then you may be doing devotion, but it's mixed devotion. It's compromised devotion. That can also be called a kind of bhakti. Karma Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti. You can have Yoga Mishra Bhakti. You want to be a yogi. You want to have the title yogi after your name. You want to be able to twist your body as a pretzel in various ways. You want people to respect you for that. You want to make a living on it. You're a yogi, okay, but you are worshipping the Lord, and you realize that that's the real goal of life. But you've got this mixed motivation. You also want to be a yogi, or you want to be a jnani, or you want to be a karmi. You know that the goal of life is to leave this world. You know it theoretically, but you're not ready for it yet. Maybe in the next lifetime, or maybe a couple of lifetimes. I've still got business here. I'm still not done enjoying. So then you're a karma mishra bhakta. You know, you're worshipping Krishna, you're chanting his names. You know that the real goal of life is just to do everything for him only. Still, you're not ready to leave this world. So jnana mishra, karma mishra. Jnana mishra bhakti means you want liberation. That's your motive. They're also called bhakti. They're special, they're an inferior variety of bhakti, but they're still bhakti. Mediocre music is still music. Mediocre poetry is still called poetry. There's a point at which someone's words are not poetry at all, they're just prose, or even incoherent, gibberish. But you can have bad or second-class poetry, bad music, mediocre music, and then first-class music. They're all called music or poetry. Like that, you can have first-class devotion, you can have second and third and fourth-class devotion also. That's called Mishra Bhakti. So if you leave out the animitta part, then that's a very general definition of all kinds of bhakti. It's bhakti, that's the essential definition. It's got to be natural inclination and directed toward Bhagavati. That other term is there. If it's not directed toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but to someone less than that, it's not bhakti. Call it something else. Don't call it bhakti. If it's for a demigod, or it's for your country, or for your family, it's not bhakti. You have no right to properly call it bhakti. If you do, you're misusing the word. Desh bhakta does not exist in the Sanskrit language. Although it's the Hindi, in the Hindi dictionary it means patriot. But there were no Deshbhaktas in the original Sanskrit culture. Yasyatma Bhuti Kuna Petru Dhatuke Swadhi Kalatradhi Bhoma Ijidi. Someone who thinks that his land is worshipable, according to the Bhagavatam, Seva Go Karaha. You can say that means he's a cow or a donkey, who are not, it means stupid, very stupid. But Vishnu Chakravarti gives another explanation of that. There's donkeys, some donkeys are high-class donkeys. They have a master, they work for Adobe, you know, and they sit around most of the day and only, you know, once or twice a day have to carry the laundry. But then there's the Gokara, the donkey that has to carry all the grass for the cows. He's carrying, you know, all day going back and forth with loads of grass. That's a very stupid donkey. Yeah, Gokara, the cow's ass. Someone who thinks that his land is worshipable, the so-called Deshbhakta. He's a jackass. So Eva Gokara. So bhakti, only proper use of the word, even if it's mixed devotion, has to be directed to the Supreme Lord. But then if you leave out the nimitta phrase, you can have some sort of mixed devotion, and it's still devotion, but it's second, third, fourth class. So here Kapiladeva is giving his general definition, and if you include the word animita, then he's defining pure devotional service. Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu is writing his book about pure devotional service. In the very beginning he defines Shuddha Bhakti. Very similar to this definition. Anyabhilashita Shunyam, that's the animita. Jnana Karma Adhyanavritam, that's the swabhaviki, natural. Anukulyena Krishnana, Anushilanam, practicing how to serve Krishna in a favorable way. That's Bhaktir Uttama, first class Bhakti or Shuddha Bhakti, unmixed. That's Rupa Goswami's definition. He gives that at the beginning of his book because that's all he's interested in his book, in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, is pure devotion. But the Vaishnavas can discuss, it's not a forbidden or obscene topic to discuss mixed devotional service. Krishna discusses it, the different kinds of mixed devotional service in his instructions to Uddhava. Lord Kapila is going to describe various kinds of mixed devotional service to his mother also in later chapters. And even Jiva Goswami, following Rupa Goswami when he wrote his expanded explanation in the Bhakti Sandarbha. In the earlier sections of that Bhakti Sandarbha, he discusses various kinds of mixed devotional service, even though Rupa Goswami didn't. So it's not a forbidden or completely rejected topic. But the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, which is our textbook, our manual for practice, is only about pure, unmotivated devotional service. We may have some theoretical interest in the other kinds, but as far as what we're interested in doing, what those in the line of Rupa Goswami are meant to do, is only the practice of Shuddha Bhakti. Sometimes we have to tolerate devotees going off into the mixed modes of devotion. What can you do? Devotional service is voluntary. But when you do that, you're straying away from the path of Rupa Goswami. When you allow your karma and jnana to become very prominent in your life, you're not any longer really following the path of Rupa Goswami. You can call it bhakti, but it's not a pure path. Pure path, as established by Rupa Goswami and as implemented for us by Srila Prabhupada, is not to let ourselves become too much influenced by these tendencies of karma, jnana, or yoga, or whatever else may be interesting us. We have to put them aside or minimize them as much as possible. The jnana interest, the karma interest, the yoga interest, and make our interest only making Krishna happy. Okay, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments?
Three questions. Number one, in the purport, at least twice, Srila Prabhupada contrasts following Vedic injunctions with performing material activities.
Yeah.
As if to imply that following Vedic injunctions are not the material, and yet Krishna equally implies in Bhagavad-gita that this is all just cycling and you should be done with it.
Yeah. I think I understand what Prabhupada's doing there. He's saying that, you know, worshipping demigods or doing sacrifice is also a kind of devotion.
Mm-hmm.
I see. He's contrasting devotion with material activity.
Mm-hmm.
Devotional service is the natural use of your mind and senses.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, contrasted to that is unnatural. There's two kinds of unnatural use of the mind and senses. One is to worship demigods.
Sakama.
If you call it Sakama Bhakti, but really when you've got strong material motives and you don't have much motive for devotion, then you're not practicing Karma Mishra Bhakti, you're practicing maybe Bhakti Mishra Karma.
Mm-hmm.
When the karma motive is more than half. You know. When the bhakti motive becomes 50% or more, then it's karma mishra bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
But when the karma is more karma motivation than bhakti, then it's, if there's any bhakti, it's still bhakti mishra karma. That's the mood of most performers of Vedic sacrifice. There may be a little devotion there, but it's not enough to make it that you can really call it bhakti. So that's worship of demigods. People in the Vedic system, cultured, civilized people, who are following the Vedic path, they're worshipping demigods and performing rituals of sacrifice. Whereas people outside the pale, barbarians, are not even doing that. They're just engaged in gross material activity, not worshipping any demigod or anybody. Maybe they go to church, maybe went to church on Sunday. You know, but that's just a show.
Off,
yeah, showing mm-hmm. off, yeah. Yeah.
So that kind of leads, that principle kind of leads into my second question, which is, you may have someone who has complete conviction, who believes fully in the principle of pure bhakti, although he cannot live up to this ideal
yes.
fully. And at the same time, he neither is he able, by dint of his karma, to manifest or to engage a great deal of good karma or good piano or even yoga
yes.
in a mixed way in that endeavor.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have a mixed devotee who may be absolutely accomplished in either karma or piano.
Yes.
If we emphasize the fact that they're all devotees, then which one is better?
Oh. The devotee who, with all sincerity, wants to just be Krishna's surrendered devotee, but he's not very competent at it. You know, maybe he had bad background or just no training in living like a civilized human being. And then the person who's so-called civilized knows all the mantras and the tantras, but he doesn't really, you know, for him devotion is just, part of the mix.
So
which is better, yeah.
We get these references, you know, Vaishnava, Gurunasya, and, you know, mantra, tantra, visharada, etc. You know, but at the same time, there's quite a lot of people who are actually interested, at least as an ideal, in pursuing pure bhakti, but they just don't come up to snuff.
Well, what makes somebody really a Vaishnava?
Exactly.
You know, the one who's a Vaishnava, he's actually satisfying Krishna. He's the one who should be honored as the better one. Whether either category, you might have someone who, is on the ball and knows all the Vedic stuff, and has been living a pure life, and he's sort of weak on the devotion. He doesn't need it so much. He's got everything together. But he can be a Vaishnava. It's not that he's automatically not a Vaishnava, and the person who's, you know, the person who comes from a barbarian background but is sincere, that he's automatically the Vaishnava. Either one could be a better Vaishnava. What's the actual criterion is that you're servant to the servant. You become a Vaishnava by becoming the surrendered disciple of a Vaishnava.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One who is a devotee of my devotee is my devotee, and one who isn't, I don't care what he's not my devotee. So that's the difference. If you want pure devotional service, you got to take the guidance of a pure devotee and get his blessings by being empowered, by pleasing and becoming empowered by the pure devotee you are allowed to engage in pure devotional service. Even if you're a rascal, even if you're, you know, a Bhattacharya, who's done everything right all your life, you still can be qualified if you surrender to the pure devotee. Whether you're Joe Schmo or you know, or Sanjay Bhattacharya, you know, it doesn't matter. Either one can surrender to the pure. And if either one doesn't, if he goes off and does his own thing, then he's not a Vaishnava.
Seems like, you know, although the references that we hear in Shastra talk about, you know, if you have X or Y qualifications that are not a Vaishnava, but it doesn't seem like we very often hear so much this actually, in fact, a much larger category of people who are interested in Krishna consciousness that just can't seem to purify themselves very easily from this lower tendency to Krishna.
Yes. Well, Krishna sees their sincerity. Abhichet said, even if his behavior is awful, if he's got every sincere intention to be my pure devotee, then Krishna considers him a sadhu.
I guess that's why.
But the key to becoming successful is to serve Krishna through by serving his devotees.
Are you right?
Yes. Do you say?
Yeah, and I guess that's why it's very important for the rest of us. Not to be very judgmental, because you really don't know.
Yeah. What a person's intentions are.
Yeah,
that's what Krishna judges the most.
It's like George Harrison, you know, would appear to have been attached to so many things, but at the same time, he expresses very profound realization.
Yeah, and Prabhupada had some nice feelings for him. He was chanting Hare Krishna in the end, wasn't he? Or
yeah.
In Benares, but...
I've been in a car accident and he's not chanting Hare Krishna.
Oh.
Wake up call.
Yeah.
Anyway, the last question is that in the second canto, chapter 10, this idea of the demigods as the presiding deity of senses is a little bit emphasized just after that, just after the 10 topics are described. I don't know if you're familiar with that section. Mm-hmm. This is the
Adhyatmic. Yes, yes, yes.
That's
a very, very complicated topic. It's discussed at the end of the Tapasandarbha. What do you want to know about it? These are certain demigods. There's a special category of demigods. I think they're called Ajana. So anyway, they're the demigods that preside over the senses and the elements. Not every demigod is in that category.
Right. Like the sun is dominating the sight, right?
Yes. Well, what about him?
I'm just curious if you kind of didn't want to elaborate on that. It's an interesting concept. I think we don't really have that so much. Certainly not in Western science.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's why, one reason why you'd want to worship these personalities. Because they're intimately involved in your personal life. You can't, without, you know, the idea of the demigod worship is that we can't live our life. We you know, we're not going to get our crops unless we worship Indra. But even more immediately, we can't lift our finger without the sanction and blessing of some demigod. Yes. So like we worship, you know, the fire, the demigod who rules the fire of digestion, and we want to, you know, devour huge amounts of food, and we enjoy doing that. So we worship the Jataragni. Yeah.
But it's also Vishnu, you see,
so again, direct
worship of Vishnu.
Yeah, it's actually Vishnu.
Yeah,
watering the root of the tree is much more effective than trying to deal separately with each leaf and all the branches. That's the third chapter of the second canto. It talks about if you want this, you can worship this demigod, you want that one, worship that one. But If you've got, if you're smart, if you've got broad intelligence, Moshe Kam Udaradi. You know, if you're not narrow-minded, if your mind is broad, then you're gonna do what's the best thing for yourself and your own self-interest. And whether you're selfish or not, worship the Supreme Lord. Even if you've got the selfish motives, the most effective way to get them fulfilled, even the most materialistic motive, is to go to the Supreme Lord with it.
So mixed emotion is better than karma.
Mixed emotion is definitely better than plain karma, worshiping demigods. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to tolerate this Satya Narayan Katha and all these mixed versions of devotional service, because it's better than being a plain demigod worshiper or a plain karmi. But it's not our line of devotional service. We don't do that in our ISKCON temples, these materialistic, you know, yagyas. Even for Narayan. Yes? We're not supposed to. It doesn't please Rupa Goswami, it doesn't please Prabhupada. You know, our ashrams and temples are for the propagation of Nam Sankirtan, not a materialistic worship.
Animitta Bhakti.
Yes, Animitta Bhakti. Now, what's Animitta Bhakti? What's the practice based on Nam Sankirtan?
That's what I was reading, Krishna Chakra Thakur was very nicely describing the characteristics of devotion, Bhakti, and he was very nicely elaborating on how it's absolutely positive. That's a very central principle.
Yes. Central, yeah.
Love,
you can have devotion that's caused, that has material causes, but it's not pure. Pure to be pure, it's got to be causeless. Okay, yes, ma'am.
For example, Bhagavad Gita Mahajan describes, we can see from it the potency of reciting Bhagavad Gita, even one shloka from it.
Yes.
And it describes how one even becomes liberated.
Yes.
So does that mean, and you spoke about how some Vaishnavas say that in order to get liberation you have to go through that steps, the
yes.
So does that mean that they do not recognize, do not acknowledge those
yes.
Mahatmas?
Mahapashari, Govinde, Mahabrahmani, Vaishnavi. They've got, if they think you've got to, you know, go through the hierarchy of demigodry. They seriously think that. That means they have weak faith in Govinda, in his name, and his Mahaprasadam, and the Vaishnavas. Because you can bypass all of that by taking shelter of those. Of Krishna, his name, his Mahaprasadam, and his devotees. Yeah. You're not obliged to anybody anymore.
Does Mahatma, for example, Bhagavad Gita Mahatma is coming from Sampurana?
Yeah, that's Skanda Purana. That one is Skanda Purana.
In general, the...
And Padma Purana has another one, yeah.
And in general, Madhvais, obviously, do accept Puranas?
Yeah, but if they see a description of immediate liberation, they have to explain it. I don't know what they got an explanation for everything. Mm-hmm. You know, we can pull anything out of the Bhagavatam and the Madhvites will explain it their way. Yeah, they're real smart at that. I don't know what their explanation of this is when it says that some rascal just recited, you know, three words of the Gita from one chapter and got immediate liberation. They'll say that, oh, okay, in his last life he was almost perfect. He just had he was Vayu in his last life. Or he's gonna have to, you know, he'll get liberation after 100 lifetimes.
But how is it that someone who has cultivated the consciousness necessary to get the adhikar for birth is Vayu, how is he suddenly going to turn into a rascal in the next life? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
But by the same
from point, our point of view, it doesn't.
By the same point, but with the same argument, you have to be careful because you can say, they'll turn it around, and I've argued with monkeys before
yeah.
we do this. It's okay, and therefore you cannot argue both sides of this point. And if you're going to say like that, then you also cannot say that somebody who's actually dramatically qualified can take more than 1%.
Well, what I've heard from them is that your birth may be circumstantial. You may have some superficial covering of tamas.
Mm-hmm.
You just said, but when you scrape it off, you'll find sattva underneath. So someone may be, you know, They say, well, ISKCON devotees, they must be, they must have been mudvites in their last life. Yeah, they must have actual mudvite constitutions. And they're just superficially barbarians. Yeah, but you know, with a little bit of rectification, that garbage on the outside is scraped off. Yeah, so they understand that what you see on the outside may not be what's deeper inside. So they can explain Prahlad and other devotees like him in that way.
I was a
busy smoking sitar player in Calcutta. It's not, they can't do it with certainty.
It's necessarily subjective.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter what you do.
You can, maybe through hypnosis you can get people to remember their last lives.
Yeah.
You generally don't
the
want
more
to.
The more I woke up, the more I know about that, and more about my best life, and I know which way that was in,
Baba would talk to a barking dog and says, serve you right.
Yeah.
Yeah, some dog is barking at Baba.
Yeah.
Baba would just talk to him, serve you right for what you did.
Yamuna said that when she was in Vrindavan, she saw Prabhupada arguing with monkey one day.
Oh.
She said that Prabhupada was speaking the perfect monkey pasha.
Wow.
Yeah. The monkey was outside. The story was about monkey seven. Prabhupada mm-hmm. said that
yeah.
monkey was coming, all monkey every day for one person. And one day Prabhupada told to not give him because he saw something was wrong. The monkey came and just started doing that thing with the time, hanging in the window. So Prabhupada talked to him and he told so many bad words to him. And people don't come again.
Yes.
That's the Indian system, right? You hire some Zumbas.
Yeah.
They'll never tell who
Yeah.
Now it will be a